Thank you, Alicia, and hello everyone. Good afternoon or good evening. I think most of you are on the other side of the Atlantic, and I'm very glad to be able to give this seminar today to talk to you about an experiment to test the discreteness of time. And this is some work which was done in collaboration with Marios Christodoulou and Andrea Di Biagio. So the question of time is central in physics. And at the very beginning of modern physics, there is this question of measuring time, how to find and to devise a good clock. By good clock, I mean stable periodic motion. This is what we need if we want to start describing in precise manner the motion of anything. And so in 17th century, for instance, we have the first reasonably good clocks which appear, typically the pendulum of Huygens. And this is characterized by the period, which is about 1 second, 1 second between two of the ticks of the clocks. And then we have made progress, both on the precision, the accuracy, and the stability of the clocks. And so at the beginning of the 20th century, for instance, we have quartz clock. So the period of quartz clock is 10 to the minus 4 seconds. So it's much better. And now we can do even better with optical clocks using strontium. And we reach very small periods, which are 10 to the minus 15 seconds. So this is certainly very small time, but we can still probe characteristic time, which are even smaller. And so for instance, we can measure the top quark lifetime, which is 10 to the minus 25 seconds. It's much less. So this is a real measurement, which is done in particle accelerators. And the reason why we can access such a precision is because we accumulate a lot of statistics, a lot of runs, and these statistics counterbalance the inaccuracy of the clocks. So we don't need so precise clock to measure a very small characteristic time. And so when doing quantum gravity, the question that is of interest for us is whether or not it is possible to probe Planck time. So Planck time, I recall the definition here. It's a clever combination of fundamental constants, h bar, g, and c. And it is very, very small at time, 10 to the minus 44 seconds. And so this seems at first sight to be an unreachable characteristic time. So Planck time is typically a quantum gravity quantity because it includes h bar quantum and g, Newtonian constant. And so probing Planck time would really mean probing some quantum gravity regime. And we know that this is very difficult, very hard. Otherwise, there are many debates which would be closed nowadays. So it is very difficult. And one idea to do this is to use high energy physics. But in that case, we know that if we want to use accelerators to reach very high energy, then we would need accelerators of astronomical size, like the solar system or maybe even the galaxy. And so this does not seem to be in any way close to our current technological capabilities. But more recently, there have been other proposals of low energy experiments to probe a quantum gravity regime. And so I will not give many details on these experiments. These are the references if you want. But the trick is to use to create entanglements via an interaction, gravitational interaction. And this is supposed to prove the non-classicality of the gravitational field. So the reason why it is possible to have low energy experiments for quantum gravity realize, is that a question? No, okay. It relies on this trick, which is that the Planck mass is actually a mesoscopic quantity. It's also a combination of the fundamental constants like h bar, c, and g. But instead of having the product between h bar and g, we have the ratio of them two. And somehow, this is the reason why the Planck mass is 10 to the minus 8 kilograms. And this is a very reasonable quantity. It's typically the mass of a grain of sand. And so, based on this fact, Bose, Marletto, Vedral, and collaborators, they have devised an experiment that could show the non-classicality of the gravitational field. I will not go further in details in this experiment, and I will now describe you directly the experimental setup that we have devised with Marios and Andrea to test the discreteness of time. So it's a very simple setup, which is here depicted on a space-time diagram. So you have space along the horizontal axis and time on the vertical axis. And you have two masses. You have a classical mass. It's classical in the sense that it's not in superposition. It's, you can imagine that's a rather big mass, although it's supposed to be to fit in within a lab. It's not such a big mass as Earth, for instance. It's small mass, but bigger than the quantum mass, small m. And so this quantum mass, some small m, is going to be put into a superposition of two branches. So the way it starts, we just have the two masses next to one another here at time t0. And then we put the quantum mass through a Stern-Gala to separate two branches. And we let it evolve for a time t. And during this evolution, there will be an interaction with the gravitational field, which is created by the source with the classical mass capital M. And then after this time, we recombine the two branches and we do some measurements. So if you look at the level of quantum states, so this is the initial quantum state for the quantum mass. So you have this C, which says that the mass is in the central channel here, and then a superposition of spins. Then we send it through a Stern-Gala. So it's going to correlate the position and the spin up in the left channel, spin down in the right channel. And then we let it evolve. And by the evolution, each branch is going to accumulate a phase, which is different on the left and the right branch. And it's different because the gravitational field generated by the classical mass M is different. And then after we recombine the two branches, and what we have at the end is a state, which is also a superposition of spins, but now there is a relative phase which has been introduced. And it is easy to compute the formula for this relative phase. It's the following. So we have the two masses, we have the time of evolution, and then some geometrical quantities like L, which is the distance between the two branches of the superposition, and D, which is the distance between the classical mass and the branch of closest approach. So now we have this state, and the measurements that we are doing is we want to access to this relative phase. We want to measure this relative phase, and to do this, we measure in a diagonal basis. And we can obtain, if we do many runs, the probability P plus to get the state plus I. And this probability is typically a sine function of the phase, delta phi, which can be written like that, with beta defined here. All right, so let's look closer at the physical meaning of this phase delta phi. It says that delta phi can be written in Planck units as the mass m times delta tau. And delta tau has this expression. And what is important is to realize that it is this delta tau is the difference of proper time between the two branches. And this fact was recognized in this paper by Marios and Carlo. But it also brings back this experiment, which had been done long time ago by Colella and collaborators. It's known as the cow experiment, usually. And the idea is that if you have the Earth, time passes at a different rate, whether you are low or high in altitude. Typically, if you are closer to the Earth center, then time passes slower. And if you are higher, it goes faster. And so here we are doing something similar, except that the classical mass, M, is not the Earth, but it's another mass, which is in the lab. And we want to measure this difference of proper time between the two clocks, which are here in the setup, the two branches. If we recombine them, we could observe interference patterns to see this difference of proper time. And so now come the hypothesis that we are introducing and that we want to test. The hypothesis is that time is not a continuum, but is discrete. It's discrete in the sense that it's flowing step by step. And also the Planck time is considered as the fundamental period of so the size of each step. And mathematically, this would mean, we interpret it like that the difference of proper time delta tau should be an integer time Planck time. And if we want to accommodate this hypothesis with the formula that was derived in the blue box, then this suggests to modify the formula in the blue box like this. So here what we have introduced is just this step function. It's the floor function, so it's the closest integer from below. And the hypothesis is that fundamentally, this is the correct formula for the difference of proper time. It's a discrete evolution of time. And if this is the case, then it will also mean that the probability, the formula for the probability, should have this fourth function inside. And this is in principle observable. Here, you have a plot of the probability P in both cases, with and without the hypothesis. So we are assuming that the mass M is small compared to Planck mass, and this simplifies. And so instead of having a sine function, you just have a linear function, which is this straight blue line here. If we introduce the hypothesis, instead of having a linear function, we will have a step function, which is in orange. And so what we want to do is to see whether it is possible experimentally to see these steps. Because if we do see these steps, this would be a proof that time is discrete at a fundamental level. So is it possible? So far, everything was very theoretical. And so in theory, everything works. But we want to be a bit practical and try to see how far it is from current technological capabilities. So of course, if we do the experiments, we will not have very clear-cut lines. We will have instead something like that. So some points which are taken one after the other, and we want to make this plot and see whether or not we do see the steps. And it might be that we don't have enough precision on the measurement, and in that case, it would be impossible to see the steps, and we would just see something like here on the left-hand side. So we need to run a complete analysis, feasibility analysis, and by this, we want to see the visibility of the steps. And so we would like to see there is a range for all these parameters, M, D, L, T, and also the magnetic field of Stein-Galla, a range of these parameters for which the steps are visible. And this means these parameters should satisfy a set of constraints, which are listed here. First of all, we want the visibility on the vertical axis. We want to be able to have a resolution here, which means that we need a very good precision on the probability that we measure. And we can always increase the probability, the precision on the probability by making more runs. If we make many times the experiment, then we increase the quality of the measurement and increase the precision on the probability. But of course, we cannot do this an infinite amount of time. So the number of time we can do it is limited from above by the total time of the experiment. It cannot last for centuries. It needs to last for a year or two, not more. So that's another constraint, total time. A third constraint is the visibility on the horizontal axis here, which is going to put further constraints on the set of parameters. Another important one is the gravitational noise, because these experiments is really acting like a gravimeter. So a very precise device to measure the gravitational field. And so if there is a bee which is flying nearby, the bee itself has a mass, so it's creating a gravitational field, and this could interfere to the experiment. And we don't want this, or what we want to know how much isolated the experiment should be from other sources of gravity. And another constraint, which is important, is the coherence, because we are doing this experiment in some medium, which has some temperature, for instance. And so there is possibility for the superposition here to decohere. And it should not decohere too fast, otherwise it's not working. So these constraints, they can be written as inequalities. I don't want to go into the details of these mathematics, but I just show them here. And now the game for us is to see whether there is a reasonable range of parameters which satisfy all these inequalities. And so we are not experimentalists, we are theoreticians, but nevertheless, we have tried to read the literature which is written by experimentalists to try to find some educated guess about some range of parameters which could work. And this is the end result of what seems to us to be the most viable set of parameters. I will not go through all the list, but I will only comment on a couple of lines. So the first is the mass. So to do these experiments, we need a mass M, which is the quantum mass in superposition, which is 10 to the minus 2 Planck mass. So this is small compared to us. It's a hundredth of a grain of sand, but it's still big if we compare it to what we can do nowadays in labs in terms of superposition. As a comparison, in the gravity-mediated entanglement, which was proposed by Bose, Marletto, Vedral, they require a mass which is 10 to the minus 6 Planck mass. And this is already slightly above what we can do in lab. But what's interesting here is that somehow we can believe that someday we will be able to put in superposition such an heavy mass. We cannot do it right now, but there is no first principle that a priori forbids it from doing it. The second parameter I want to comment on is this A. This A is a way to quantify the degree of isolation that we need to screen from the gravitational noise. And the level of control that we need is as high as a bee, which would be flying 200 meters away. So this is very sensitive. This experiment is extremely sensitive, but still, it sounds like if we are doing this experiment in space, for instance, this is maybe a degree of isolation that can be reached. And last parameter I want to comment is the pressure, because maybe this is not obvious, but it seems that this could be actually the most serious difficulty in the experiment, because we need to reach pressures which are really, really low. This is because otherwise the decoherence time is too big. And this is very low. We can compare it, for instance, with the interstellar medium, which is 10 to the minus 14 Pascal. So there is a three order of magnitude between the two. But this difficulty also exists in previous experiments like GME experiments. This is also the case. All right, so what is the conclusion of this? So I propose to you two conclusions, depending on your mind right now, if you are optimistic or pessimistic. The bold conclusion is to say that we can probe Planck time regime. It is possible with this experiment to see whether something strange is happening at Planck time. And the more cautious conclusion is that maybe probing Planck time is not so impossible as we used to think. It might be valuable to start thinking seriously about this possibility to see the granularity of time. So now I would like to give you some intuitive understanding for why it is possible, because certainly this is something a bit surprising as a conclusion, to think that we can reach 10 to the minus 44 second. This seems to be really small. And so the intuitive understanding, there are some reasons to believe that this is possible. The first is that we are taking advantage that gravity is very weak. For instance, if you take an apple, which generates a gravitational field, and 1 meter away you put two bees, which are nearby, separated by 1 centimeter, and you let them evolve during 1 second, during this 1 second, the proper time of the two bees is going to acquire a difference of 10 to the minus 30 seconds. And this is a good thing for us, because see, with macroscopic data, 1 meter, 1 centimeter, 1 second, because gravity is very weak, the proper time difference is going very, very small. And we are happy that it is very, very small, because we want it to be as small as Planck time to reach this scale. The second reason for why this is possible is because we are using the magnifying power of interferences. I've always been very surprised to think how powerful this is. When I was in high school, for instance, we were doing this experiment of measuring the breadth of the hair, of a piece of hair, through interference. We were sending light, and then we were measuring with a ruler on the screen the size of the gaps, and we were able this way to measure something which is very small, which is the breadth of a hair. And so we are using here this power of interferences as well, with the superposition of the quantum math. Now, another aspect that should be pointed out is the leverage effect of the fundamental constant. By this, I mean that we are measuring a phase, 5, which is of order unity. And we want to measure a time which is about Planck time. And the way we go from one to another is by multiplying with constants like h bar, which are very small. And somehow we are using the fact that we know what is the value of this fundamental constant, which is measured by other means. And we introduce it back in our formulas. And this enables us to magnify Planck time on the right-hand side and to reach a phase which is of order unity. And last but not least, there's the leverage effect of statistics. If we want to, that's what I was mentioning at the beginning of the talk, it is that if we want to reach a very high precision, we need a lot of runs, a lot of data, and this way we can make something interesting. Last, before I conclude, let me mention two historical examples, which are a bit similar in spirit, in the sense that thanks to them, it was possible to probe a microscopic scale by using many low-energy mesoscopic particles. And the first example is 1905 Einstein. And what he's suggesting is that it is possible to measure the size of atoms just by looking in a microscope. If you're looking in a microscope, of course, you don't see the atoms directly. You cannot measure them. But what you can see is the pollen grains, which move randomly. And by looking at this Brownian motion and some theory behind, of course, you are able to deduce what should be the size of atoms. And the other example, which is maybe less known, is the experiment of Millikan. So it's just a bit later, and Millikan was able to measure for the first time the elementary electric charge. And actually he has done two things. He has measured the elementary electric charge, but he has also shown that the electric charge was a discrete quantity, that it came in discrete packets. This wasn't known before. I mean, there was the hypothesis of the electron, but Millikan has really shown, and so this is even closer to what we are doing, because it's really about showing that some physical quantity, for him it was the electric charge, for us it's proper time, this quantity comes in discrete packets. And so the way he has done this was by observing the motion of some oil drops, which are mesoscopic. The drops, because of static electricity, they have some charges, but very little, just 1, 2, 3. And by looking at the motion in an electric field, he was able to deduce by some computation the electric charge. And so this is one of the impressive feats of last centuries, of the beginning of last century. All right, so I'm now at the end of my talk. This is the conclusion. So the two points to remember, to take away, are that we have proposed an experiment to test an hypothesis about the possible granularity of time. And we have tried to show by an educated guess that actually it is not too far removed from current technological capabilities. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Pierre, for that answer. Okay, are there questions? First from students. I don't see questions from the student. Or Hank, do we have a question? Hank, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, like, because in the particular experimental setup that you have drawn, so it appears that the gravitational effect would be larger the longer you let the states evolve, right?
So let me go back to the relevant slides. Yes. So you
Yeah.
say, so can you say again?
Yeah, so the longer the two states evolve, the stronger the sign, this delta phi, this
Yes.
delta phi, yeah.
Yeah, that's correct.
So now how, because like usually when you have a superposition of states and you have an actual experimental setup, like this superposition of states, let's call them qubits or something, they sort of couple to the heat bath in your system. So after some time, they're gonna thermalize and then collapse into one of the states. So what is, do you have like a bound for observing quantum effects versus before these things thermalize? Like what is there a finite
Yes.
window?
Yeah, so yeah, perfectly correct. Like T cannot be too long because otherwise the superposition is going to decohere because the branches are going to interact with the environment. And so T should be small enough. And if you look at the set of the values that we have in the end, I know, where is it? There, yeah. T is a tenth of a second. So it's relatively short, and short with respect to what? Well, short with respect to a second, and the second is the typical time of decoherence that we have computed under this condition of pressure and temperature. So you have two sources of decoherence. One is the black body radiation, photons, and the other is the imperfect vacuum. The medium is not perfect vacuum, so you will have maybe some gas particles that really come. And we want this decoherence time to be of about 1 second, and this imposes this condition for the pressure and the temperature. And in that case, then it's fine, we can run the experiments.
Right, okay, I see. Because I mean, just generally speaking, 10 to the minus 1 is kind of is quite long, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, for a superposition, it is quite long.
Yeah. But I did see that you're in like quite lower temperature, so I guess that makes sense. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
Okay, next there is a question by Bianca.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you can you motivate there was this kind of claim that you say if time is discrete, you get a floor function. And so if time is discrete, for me, I guess it means it has a discrete spectrum. So I would rather guess what you should get is kind of a collapse to either value of having the floor or floor plus one, and that this is a probability kind of distribution in itself. So can you motivate this kind of simple assumption that
Yes.
it's just a floor function?
Yeah. So I have an extra slide maybe to help you understand this. So this is the assumption that we are making. In words, time is flowing step by step, and Planck time is the fundamental period. And when we translate this equation, it gives that the difference of proper time, delta tau, is an integer value of Planck time.
Okay,
And so,
can
of
you
course,
just I don't understand if you say time is flowing step by step.
what it means step by step?
Yeah.
Well, just mean discrete, like it's just like a tick. So okay, there is no. So this is an hypothesis that we are introducing by hand, and we do not motivate it by any of the current theory we have for quantum gravity. So in a sense,
okay, so it's not related to spectra of any kind of operator.
Well, then of course, ultimately, if we do have a quantum theory of gravity, we would hope that we could explain such a behavior as being the spectrum of some operator, like the time operator. But there are several problems when we want to do this nowadays and try to find some theoretical justification for this hypothesis. One is that it is not clear which is the correct observable. Because here, the observable that we are considering is a difference of proper time. But maybe one could say it should not, the relevant observable is not a difference of proper time, but is the proper time itself. And the proper time, it's the proper time itself, which should be quantized and not a difference of proper time. And this can introduce changes because, for instance, in loop quantum gravity, we know that some geometric operators have a discrete spectrum, like the area, which is written here, has this behavior, which when J is sufficiently large, is somehow linear in J. So the area has also a step-by-step evolution. But of course, if we look at the dimensions between the area and the time, and if we think that in loop quantum gravity as well, time should be discrete, this is not proven, but we could think since the area is discrete, time is discrete, we could guess that the time should go as the square root of n and not as n. You see, because okay, area is dimension square of time. And so if from loop quantum gravity, a more reasonable guess maybe would be that the difference of proper time goes as square root of n. And we have, in the paper, we have looked at this possibility. And in that case, it's, our analysis still holds, still working. Here you have the graph of the probability. And you see that now we have this green step function, and this is what we would have if we have a square root instead of a linear evolution for the difference of proper time. But the steps are still visible in more or less the same condition. But as I said, it is not clear that the relevant observable is the difference of proper time. It could be that the relevant observable is proper time itself, and in which case, this is what we should have. It's tau and not delta tau, which goes as square root of n. And if this is the true physical thing happening, then this is very problematic because this implies that the difference of proper time is linear in n, but now we have a very large factor below, which is this big n, which come into the game. And this somehow kills the visibility of the steps and makes the experiment completely impossible to test. So yeah, as a conclusion to this, why this hypothesis? So we have proposed this hypothesis by hand because somehow it makes sense to imagine that the difference of proper time can be seen like a very tiny clock which ticks, and between two of the ticks there is Planck time. But this intuitive understanding is not yet backed up by quantum gravity theory. It's not necessarily in contradiction with it, but it's not completely clear what is the relevant observable in that game. Does it answer the question, more or less?
I got a bit more confused.
Sorry.
But I think I think I'm a bit confused by making a difference, or that one should make a difference between time as an evolution parameter and proper time as something or something you measure. With your scaling argument, I would say if you start with area, one should probably assume that you measure something which is time, times some constant small length distance. So I wouldn't assume that this square root of n argument goes through. You know, if you do assume that you can take this area scaling there, then I would assume if you try to measure time, there's always the same kind of amount of length dimension or spatial dimension attached to it. So then it would also go, the time then also goes just linearly with n or with j. So in any case, I think it's just that I'm not sure about between this distinction between time as an evolutionary parameter and proper time as a measurement. And
So it is true that here we are not directly measuring delta tau. What we are measuring is the phase, delta phi. And then delta phi is proportional to delta tau. But we assume that this delta tau has some physical reality. What is nice about delta tau is that it's a covariant quantity, for instance, because it's really a difference of proper time. So it's not just a parameter. It is really a physical quantity which has some invariant meaning. And we don't measure it directly, we measure the phase, but we assume that if there is some underlying reality for this delta tau, it should show up when we measure the phase.
Okay.
Carlo?
Thank you. Thank you, Pierre. Nice presentation. Very nice. I want to make a comment. In fact, Bianca has already anticipated sort of the topic of what I wanted to comment upon. First of all, I think this is super interesting, and it's one of the few, in fact, directions for phenomenology of quantum gravity that is worth looking at for real. So, congratulations for the work that the three of you have done. I think it's great. There are a lot of things to develop this further. Of course, from an experimental point of view, from point of view of the analysis that you've done, but also from a theoretical point of view. And the kind of questions that Bianca was raising is simply one of the ones that needs to be developed and better understood. You definitely have made a lot of steps ahead from the proposal of measuring discrete of time that Marius and I had in the first paper on that. This is what you're doing is slightly different, it's far more clear, and you have this analysis of visibility. Now you were very clear, and I think appreciate that, in saying we make an hypothesis, which is the one on the slide, which we can see about that, the one that Bianca was questioning. And let's separate that from the question whether there is a quantum theory of gravity that predicts it or not. So it seems to me that from the theoretical perspective, that's a key question that should be addressed to understand the interest of this this experiment, because there are many laboratory experiments of quantum gravity proposed and actually being done in laboratory around the world today, but I would distinguish them in two kinds. Those like the Bose, Merletto, the gravity entanglement experiments that you from which you started, which are phenomena that what we very much believe that should be real for everything we consider reasonable quantum gravity, because essentially they are predicted by any theory of quantum gravity, or by most theories of quantum gravity, sorry, and wide speculations of, well, maybe this could happen, but in fact, they're not predicted by theory of quantum gravity. So the key question is, does this way of discrete of time belong to the first or the second class? That seems to be the key question. It's worth doing in any case if it is an experiment, but in the second case is most likely give a negative result. In the first case, if it works, it's truly a so the question is then does this hypothesis delta tau is NTP follow from what we know about quantum gravity? And it seems to me that it's not such a vague question after all, because it doesn't really require the full machinery of quantum gravity. It's only require a clean sort of standard quantum mechanical analysis where you cleanly say, this is my system, this is my apparatus, just use Copenhagen here. There's no reason of going or decoherence, whatever you like better. No reason to go to fancy things, and I think it can be addressed. And the question is not so much. It seems to me that the core question is not so much which one is observable being measured, because observable measure is pretty clear here. It's delta tau. It's a function of g mu nu, which you can write as an integral of g mu nu along two lines in some way. We know what it is. And it might not be too hard in the quantum theory to, I mean, the problem is that in loop quantum gravity, we're working at gauging with G00 is one. So it's a particularly inconvenient gauge for that, but nevertheless, it's a gauge issue. So it can be solved. The key question seems to me, and that should be addressed, is whether what is being measured it's an eigenvalue or an expectation value. That seems to me the key question, especially since the measurement itself is done by repetition of the same precisely the same experiment with the same parameters, because you have to do it with different parameters. But the point is that at each parameter, you have to do it many, many times. So the question is that the phi be measured, delta phi be measured, delta tau, is that be measured an expectation value or a eigenvalue? And that's not clear to me. And I think that's, sitting down and thinking for a while, we should be able to figure this out. Because if it is an eigenvalue, it might be complicated, but I would be surprised if there's a continuous spectrum for that particular operator. Mm-hmm. Very surprised. I'm ready to bet 90%, 10% that it's going to be discrete. But if it is an expectation value, on the other hand, the expectation value of the angular momentum in the z direction of a spin 1/2 particle is continuous. It's not discrete. So that seems to me the open question, which I would like you or somebody else to address. I am moderately optimistic, so I think that there's a chance that the result could come out in the right direction. I mean, no, this is actually measuring something which is a eigenvalue, and therefore, if there's some discreteness, will come out, would show up. The main experiment in quantum gravity in quantum mechanics, where you see these jumps down with a repeated thing, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand both your comments, and I agree. This is indeed something that should be thought further. I don't have any answer to that question so far. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, next there is a question by Anna.
Yes, hello. I was just wondering,
when you showed the estimates for little m and big M, you said 10 to the minus 10 and 10 to the minus 9. So mm-hmm. only one order of magnitude difference. Where are you drawing the line between a classical and quantum mass?
Well, I would say that the difference between classical and quantum is not about the mass of the particle, but what I call the classical mass is just a mass which is not in superposition. Like we just stay there, and where the quantum mass, we force it through a Stein-Galois so that we have two branches. And of course, it is easier to put in superposition a particle which has a lower mass, but so indeed, what's true here is that the two masses are very close to one another, and the classical mass plays the role of a source for the gravitational field, while the quantum mass here plays the role of a test for the gravitational field, of a test particle. The difference is not big, but somehow it's big enough. What's problematic here is the possibility to control the gravitational noise, because if the mass M was much bigger, then the gravitational noise, which is far away, would not be so important. But because M is small, also we need to be very careful about the controls that we have on the noise.
Yeah, I guess my question was also more in the direction then of you're making sure by spatial separation or somehow that the big mass doesn't go into superposition.
It's not going to.
Which is fine.
I mean, it's difficult to create a superposition of branches. Like to make this superposition for the quantum particle, we need to use very high magnetic field, the Stein-Galois, to create this superposition. So it's rather something difficult to accomplish, because this mass is certainly small, but it's still very big compared to the quantum real and compared to what we can do actually nowadays for the superposition. So I'm not really worried by this aspect, I would say.
Next, Bianca, do you have another question?
Yeah, if there's nobody else asking questions. I was wondering if it's probably kind of, I don't know, more correct to say what you probe is the discreteness of space-time distances, and whether you would see a difference when if you have a theory where space is only discrete or has discrete spectra, but time would be continuous, for instance.
I'm not sure to understand why you would like to say this, because the hypothesis that we are making is really about the difference of proper time.
I looked at your graph, and it's not very clear to me whether the particles always stay somewhere, but they never stay somewhere, they always move some distance. And wouldn't you say you rather measure space-time distance? I mean, you say proper length or proper time, that's the space.
Yeah.
So it's a space-time distance.
But
it's more, it's possibly a philosophical question about the nature of time, but at the end you do measure space-time distance, and in that respect, like, if say what does appear actually say in 3D is that time distances are discrete, but space is actually continuous.
Uh-huh.
And then 4D, well, it seems that they have these areas discrete, but both time-like and space-like areas are discrete. But assume that there's a version where lengths are discrete and time is continuous. Uh-huh. So you would say that we would not measure this time discreteness, and we would not see the space discreteness.
Yes, I think these experiments would not see. Yeah, these experiments would not see a space discreteness if time was continuous. Although, my guess is that it could be adapted in a way to see the space discreteness, but instead of making an assumption about how could this that's not clear to me because here in fact what's happening in the two branches, you can imagine that along this branch and this branch time is discrete, so instead of having a continuum, we just have many, many dots, one after the other. And if we look, this time here is 1/10 of a second. And so we have many, many dots here along this line. We have 10 to the 43 dots along this line. That's huge. But because of interference, we can cancel all of them, basically, except a very few number, which is the difference of proper time. And this is this number, the difference, the number of dots between the left and right branch that we see. So now if you make the assumption that actually time is continuous, but space is discrete, I am imagining that it should be along the horizontal axis along space that I have many, many dots. And but here I don't see how we could see.
I guess then you also need to assume that you are in some rest plane where it becomes a bit difficult with relativity.
Yeah.
If you assume that you're in rest with respect to the discreteness of space or something.
Yeah. So maybe a possibility, but I'm just thinking loudly now, but maybe a possibility could be that the particle is going to be attracted toward the mass M, and so it's not going to be deviate slightly. And so maybe by looking at the deviation, there would be a way to measure some very small steps in space. I don't know.
Okay. This is yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Welcome.
Are there more questions? Okay, so let me also ask a question because to be honest, I'm not sure that I understood the setup properly because so what you would like to measure is this delta phi that it is in some way related to the Planck mass, so you throw, or at least to the Planck length, so you would argue that maybe is somewhat related to quantum gravity. Mm-hmm. But what I would associate with quantum gravity is regimes where you have fluctuations of the space-time. While in this case, I would say that what you are what is really quantum in these systems is the superposition of the particle, but the gravitational field in this situation between the two masses seems to me to be classical. So I'm a little bit confused on how one can probe a quantum property of gravity in an experiment where gravity seems classical to me.
Yeah, so you've well understood indeed that here there is no superposition of the gravitational field. Here the gravitational field is classical. It is created by the source, which is the classical capital M here. This is this mass. And then the quantum mass N is just a test particle, which is evolving on a classical background. And so it's not quantum gravity in the sense there's no superposition of the gravitational field. But yet it is quantum gravity in the sense that we are measuring a time which can reach Planck time, and Planck time has both h bar and g. So it's the idea that even if you have a classical gravitational field, if you look at a very small scale, this field is not a continuous field, but is rather on a lattice in some sense, in some classical sense. That's the somehow the naive picture that we have here, and which certainly is not easy to reconcile with quantum perspective, but it's still quantum in the sense we discretize space-time, classical space-time, we discretize it to observe some chunks of it, like a gravitational field on the lattice.
Okay, so in a sense, one could distinguish between quantizing the space-time itself in terms of time and space, and quantizing gravity in the sense of gravitational field. And in this type of experiment, you would access only one of the two aspects, assuming that both are there in natural law.
No, I would say ultimately both should be the same in the end. But that's two perspectives. That's two different perspectives on the same question. One.
Well, not in all theories of quantum gravity would one would in the end have a space-time discreteness. So and this is probably related to what Bianca said, that this would so discreteness would arise so in terms of spectra, and that really depends on the theory that you are considering. So it's not obvious that the space time is quantized in the sense of discreteness of time and space. So this would be one particular aspect that would emerge in some specific theories, probably, but not not 100% sure of the relation between having what you call a step-by-step evolution of time and discreteness in the spectra of operators, as it happens, for instance, in loop quantum gravity, but not, does not happen in all theories.
Yeah, I think I agree, yeah. Yeah, in a sense, the approach that we are having here is maybe not familiar to theoreticians, because usually theoreticians, they start from some abstract theory and they go down to experiment. Here, we have been a bit wild in the sense that we have started some experimental setup and we have taken some hypothesis, but we think it's not too wild hypothesis, but still, it's introduced by hand, and then we are trying to see what are the consequences. Maybe it's not very familiar for the usual approach to theories.
Thanks. So there is one more question by Nosrat.
Thank you for nice talk. Sorry for maybe it is some philosophical question. The discreteness of time is not so clear for me. What does it me really jump in the time. If we cannot understand, cannot measure, cannot have some continuous some notion of time, then can we understand jumping in the time? We are living in a world that the time is continuous, maybe.
I'm hearing you very badly, very poorly. I don't know if it's only me.
Oh, sorry.
I'm wondering about the meaning
of the discreteness of the time. It's not so clear for me.
What is its meaning? The meaning of the discreteness of time?
Yeah. Maybe it is a very difficult question.
yes, it's a difficult question, but a very relevant question. So we can give many meaning to discreteness of time. As I said, what is the relevant observable to measure time in such or such context is not always clear. And so what should be discrete? What is the physical quantity that we expect to have discrete eigenvalues is not clear. So first question is to identify what is the good observable. Another question is to ask what is the spectrum of the observable, because there are several ways to be discrete. One can be discrete with a linear function that we have here, but we can be discrete in many ways. We can have other spectrums, like the hydrogen atom, the energy of the hydrogen atom has also a discrete spectrum, but it's not proportional to n. It's proportional to 1/n². So it's a different way to be discrete. So here, in a sense, we are being a bit naive about what we mean by discreteness of time. It's the idea, the intuition behind it, I think, is very simple. It's the idea of a movie. When you go to the cinema and you look at the movie, you have a feeling of continuity, but you know actually that these are only images, one after the other, and the resolution, your brain is not smart enough to see that these are discrete images and believes form of continuity. Now, I could think that this is the same for physical processes. When they evolve according to the Schrödinger equation, maybe it's not, we should not use maybe differential equations, but instead we should replace them by some discrete equations where instead of time, we just have a discrete label. And so our feeling of the continuity of time, which would just be an illusion, the illusion of a movie with a very high time frame per second. There would be 10^44 frames per second. So that's the intuition we have to explain the what would mean to have this discreteness of time. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, maybe.
Welcome.
More questions? Okay, so if not, let's thank Pierre again.
Thank you all for attending and for your questions.